This is the State of Things broadcasting from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. For a century, advertisements have paired text with images to convince people to buy something. But in many ways, ads aren't just about the product. They can construct an image. A new art exhibit looks at the ways ads have shaped how we think about race, gender, and beauty. The exhibit looks at ways advertisers in the last century marketed specifically to white women. Artist Hank Willis Thomas takes away the ad's original text to explore representations of white femininity. The collection is called Unbranded, A Century of White Women, 1915 to 2015. It's on display at the Wetherspoon Art Museum in Greensboro through early December. And joining me now is Emily Stamey, who is the curator of exhibitions at the Wetherspoon. Welcome, Emily. Good to talk with you. Also with me is Leila Villaverde. She is a professor in Cultural Foundations of Education at UNCG. Hello, Leila. Good to talk to you. So, Emily, tell us about this. Why? What about this exhibit? How does this strike you as a historian?
As a historian, well, it is historic by its nature. So the works in the show are arranged chronologically. The artist in the full series took one image from each year from 1915 to 2015. And we have a selection of 38 of them on view at the Wetherspoon now. But as you said, in each one of them, he digitally takes away all of the text, all of the logos, anything that gives away the brand or the product that was being sold. And we're left with these really amazing, very perplexing, in many instances, images that we realize are also selling us ideas about gender, race, class, all of these ways that we shape our ideas about one another.
Tell us about the artist, Hank Willis Thomas, and any of his motivations that you've been able to determine.
So this is the second of his Unbranded projects. He has always had a great interest in media and the images that we get from the media. And in a previous project that he did in 2008, which he called Reflections in Black by Corporate America, Unbranded Reflections in Black, that project looked at images that were marketed at black consumers from 1968, the year of King's assassination, through 2008, the year of Obama's inauguration. And so taking that historic look, he moves on to this project of the Unbranded White Women in 2015, anticipating the possibility that Hillary Clinton would become the presidential nominee for the Democrats.
Well, let's talk, Leila, tell me a little bit about this and the way in which removing the text really forces us to reinterpret these images.
Yeah, absolutely. It really sort of creates an invitation to do even more inquiry and more research. So by not having the reference of the text, it forces the viewer to both figure out what they're bringing to the table as well as where it's located, its time, its epoch, its cultural mores around that particular image.
And it's a kind of dynamic, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, I bring whatever prejudices and ideas I may have already had about these issues, race, gender, femininity, but also you're pushing the image to a certain extent by either reinforcing stereotypes or recontextualizing those stereotypes.
Yeah, and it's that process of the in-between that's where pedagogy, I think, really sort of unbounds. And the student is then responsible, or the viewer or the participant, to make up that meaning in and of itself.
Well, let's talk about these. We've got them at our website, some of the images, stateofthings.org, and you can take a look. They're up there right now, and we'll hold them up and show the audience. And I will talk with you, Leila, and then Emily. This one is called, what is this one called? Chained to Perfection, from 1965. So tell us what we're looking at here.
Well, you have a series of legs chained together at the ankle with these sort of gold cuffs and links, and then you have a gentleman with a headpiece and smoking a hookah. Looking at them.
And the legs are hanging from the top of the page down, sort of dripping over the top of the page, and he's looking up with some delight, I would say. And I don't know if it's the hookah or the legs or some combination, but he's a very happy man at the moment. He has a turban. He's a white man, vaguely swarthy, perhaps. I don't know what that means, but it's an odd expression, and without the text. Very strange. What do you, Emily, let me ask you, kind of what you take from this as you look at it?
Well, the first thing that strikes me are these shackles that are around these women's legs. I mean, they're in these beautiful hosiery with these high heels on, but they are all linked to one another. They are literally chained and bound. So you have that disturbing level. But then, as you pointed out, we also have this perplexing figure underneath them, which he's white, but he's got this ornate turban on, and he's got this hookah, and he's kind of laughing, and are we laughing at him? And what is all of this, and what does it all mean?
All right, so here, spoiler alert now. What is this ad about? Is this about hash? Is this a hashish commercial? Or no, couldn't be. Couldn't be 65.
65. It is, in fact, an ad for hosiery. It's an ad for pantyhose.
So, Layla, what do you make of this? I mean, again, in terms of the imagery and what it does for us and what it says about both our understanding at the time and how it may have pushed that image forward, mm-hmm. what do you think is happening here?
Well, I mean, I think that we can't tell for sure. I mean, you're working off of the expertise of graphic designers and advertisers that are putting together and working off of the sensibilities of an era. And certainly as we're looking at it now in 2016, we're inscribing different things to it. But it asks lots of questions about the ways in which women are restricted, that which type of women, the relationship between women and men. And so it gets us down a particular road of understanding equity in many, many levels.
Right. And certainly the sort of exotic nature. I mean, we're not going to make him really from someplace else, but we'll try to pretend that he is. What's the impact of that, do you think, on us? That we somewhat displace the sense of lust that he feels? Maybe as a white guy, I can't feel that, so I'm going to transfer that to somebody else?
Well, it speaks to our sort of twisted relationship and exoticization with the other, as well as admiration. We're constantly looking down on the other towards difference, and yet wanted to be different ourselves.
Yeah. Layla, tell us about how this collection illustrates white women's complicated relationship with women of color.
Yeah, I think all of it is really about racial provocations, regardless of the relationships of who's in the image. It's always about that relationship of race and gender, the intersections of that. So even though the majority of the images place a white woman centrally in the image, it really is about all the relationships around it and what makes that possible in a particular time period.
And we have one here from 1924. It's called "There Ain't Nothing I Can Do or Nothing I Can Say," is what the piece is called. And Emily and Layla, tell us about, let me ask you the question, Emily, again, how this plays into this larger question that we're talking about. Well, we should describe it, too, if you wouldn't
mind.
So
the image has these two white women in the foreground, one sitting, one looking at the other, and the one standing is modeling a dress instead of primping before a mirror. And then in the background, behind them both, we have the black maid who's carrying the stack of freshly laundered clothes and smiling, of course, as she does her work. So we have this, you know, terrible stereotype back there. And this is one of the images that is great to then compare to later images in this series. So you do watch these evolutions of images. And the artist himself describes them as sort of one step forward and sometimes two steps back, both in terms of the gender dynamics and the racial dynamics in there. So there's an image at the very end of the exhibition from 2010 in which we have another direct interaction between a black woman and a white woman. And in that case, we have the tennis star Serena Williams facing this petite woman in a suit jacket, towering over her. Mm-hmm. So we have this very different staging as compared to that 1924 image. So now the black woman is front and center. She's the more powerful woman in the image. And yet that image is troubling in so many of its own rights as well.
Right. Well, and I think we might be expected to know that this is a comedian who is a well-known sort of satire comedian playing the subservient white woman. And so so by the way, let's talk about this one with this is Serena. This is a Tampax ad, by the way. So the box, the gift box, presumably, is that. And so now, I mean, what's the context of that? And right, so there, it's not necessarily turning the tables. It's playing to the type, the stereotype.
Well, and the woman that Serena Tower is over, who's bringing her this lovely box of tampons, her monthly gift, is dressed in green with leaves in her hair. She is supposed to be Mother Nature. And so the very fact that we make Mother Nature white, tiny, petite, modestly dressed in this particular type of suit, I mean, there's all sorts of other implications wrapped up within that.
Again, going back to this other ad, and tell us about the one we described earlier, because this one from 1924, we've got the smiling maid and the you know, gentrified, genteel white women primping her hair. What was this for? What was the product?
This was for, I have not found the original ad, but I found a reference to its text, and it had something to do with laundering your cotton clothes so that they'd be more like linen. Hmm. And of course, the ad's then directed at the white woman who might buy that product, but it would be the black maid who would actually be doing the work to make the clothes look nice.
Layla, it's interesting that going back as far as 1924 and certainly before that, that the idea, if you're in public relations or marketing or advertising, you know that these are stories and types that need to play a role in selling your product. Mm-hmm. So race and gender will help you sell a product going back to 1924.
Yeah, and I think it's also about power. I mean, the ways in which we read the images is important as well. If you juxtapose again the two images of the maid and Serena, some would argue that in understanding that scenario a little bit better, you see that the maid actually has quite a bit of power in making the lady's well-being much more smoother, right? And so if you think about the ways in which the cotton is supposed to feel like linen, she's the one that has the authority to do that given how well she does the linens. And so if you return the gaze and kind of look at how complex these issues can be, it's not sort of like here you have the lady of the house and here you have domestic workers. It's about understanding how powerful and how relational those things were then and now, especially also with the image with Serena, where you have then Mother Nature potentially weakening her athletic power.
Emily, tell us about Hank Willis Thomas again and how he got or came up with the names for these pieces.
So he plays with the text that comes from the original advertisement. So in some, there's sort of a straight taking of a phrase or a set of words that might have been in the advertisement. And in others, there's very much a play on the words or a modernizing of it and giving it sort of a phrasing that we recognize as contemporary today.
And Layla, you talked about the scope of this and watching the evolution, as Emily did as well. What does it say about the waves of feminism as we look at these ads over the decades?
Yeah, it's funny because the first time Emily and I walked through it, I said, my goodness, this seems like, you know, we're back talking about second wave feminism. And yet it's sort of an entry, and depending on how what you bring to the table, that may actually be what you're seeing. Once again, a commentary on middle-class white women. But the more that you sort of peel away at these works, you realize it's much more complex than that. And that, for some, that may be a historical perspective, and for some, it's completely ahistorical because they have no real access to that knowledge. The newer generations may not even sort of have a real literate understanding of the different waves.
More complex in what ways? In other words, what does my going to this exhibit perhaps reveal to me that I might not have come away with even if I had taken gender studies?
Well, first, I would hope that you would see yourself as a knowledge producer, right? That you are bringing as much to it. Your read is as important as what the artist is putting in there. I mean, I think one of the things he said previously about his artwork is that he likes it to be a collaboration. So I think that is the main thing, taking away the complexity, the intersectionality of race, class, gender, power, access, privilege, equity, and sort of figuring out where does that really lie today, given the chronology of these images.
And this is not just the province of artists and art appreciators. I mean, this was how the public relations business was built. It was very intentional, based on a lot of psychological principles that said, you know, at a certain point, stop talking about the virtues of the product and start creating an image based on what people presume and already know about power, what's already in play. So making the buyer and the consumer a collaborator in this was the business of public relations, mm-hmm. certainly going back to the early part of the 20th century. It's not accidental.
No. And you're making culture that way.
And you're making culture. So let's talk about this one now. This is a little more recent piece. Let me see if I can. This is 1976. And tell us about this one.
So we've got this blonde, I believe it's Christie Brinkley, but I'm not entirely sure, swinging through the jungle. And she's on this vine. She's wearing her green bikini. She's got her headband that perfectly matches the bikini, of course, and her hair is perfectly in place. But then she's got these cowrie shells on her arms. She's got this bone necklace around her neck. It raises all kinds of questions about who do we imagine in the jungle? How do we define that person in the jungle? The title of the piece, as the artist gives it, is "The Natives Will Get Restless." Mm-hmm. The tagline from the original ad was "Tropical Blend for the Savage Tan." And so how are these ideas of the native, of the savage, being played out in the image of this blonde lady swinging through the jungle?
And again, a complicated relationship between races, right? The idea of a gaze that admires a certain skin tone at the same time finds it exotic and other, right, in the same.
Right.
And I would add, and maybe it's just me, I think the vine is provocatively placed, but it's possibly that I'm bringing something to this that no one had seen before. What have been the reactions now to this?
You know, we've only had the show open for a little while, but the reactions have been so interesting to me because as Layla, you know, alluded to, your interpretation is going to depend on what you bring to it.
And that's
so
sad. And now that you say that, that's really sad, given
what you said, okay.
Really kind of sad.
But to watch different generations interact with these images and to see a class of, you know, 18-year-old, you know, first-year students come through, and how do they react to them versus, you know, how do some of our museum docents who might be a bit older, how do they interact with it? What do I bring to it as an art historian versus colleagues who've come in from other disciplines and looked at it? It's an amazing conversation starter. Mm. I mean, I love this project because it asks more questions than it gives answers. And it gets all of us talking when we're in there.
Layla, given the fact that these pieces are of their time and place, and what Emily just said about different generations certainly seeing these images differently, do you take away from this, are there essential images, are there essential stereotypic images that we might all respond to in the same way? Or are you beginning to think that everything is sort of in its own context?
I mean, you have certain patterns, obviously, that certain identities that are ascribed more power within society, right? I mean, white women, white men, you have whiteness and you have gender that may obviously ascribe more power to some people than others. But yet, again, those are not sort of double or triple whammies, as you would think. They're intersections. So
right.
It really depends on how class factors into that, one's education, one's access, the context. So it shifts tremendously. But I do think that it is a commentary on the time period more so than any static stereotype.
That said, I mean, again, and advertisers are already playing with what's in your head now. They're not really too interested in driving you to do much more than buy the thing. But it leads to the question, could I, if my goal was to bring more equality among genders and races, could I create images that would have that effect, or doesn't it work that way?
I would hope you would continuously struggle to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, but how much of that, again, depends on, I mean, I've got about a half a minute left. Maybe we've got a second, for instance, to talk about this one.
This is an image from 1951. We have a woman sitting behind a desk at a typewriter. Again, her hair is perfectly in place, her makeup's perfectly done, but she's got this horrified, shocked look on her face, and she is bound up in a straitjacket. So she is actually not able to do her work at all.
Yeah, I have to know what we're selling here.
We are selling office supplies.
So if she just goes to Staples, the jacket comes off and she's a happy lady. Is that the idea?
Something like that, yeah.
Wow. Wow, because it really is, and it does. I mean, she's screaming. She's in terror. This is in a straitjacket, which, again, I think, you know, goes a long way to sort of reinforcing ideas about women and sanity, and if that becomes a part of the larger narrative, it's important.
Right, and one of the things the artist has said, looking at images from sort of that 40s, 50s, 30s even era, was that he was amazed looking at these images of violence against women in a lot of ways. But thinking about it at the same time, in a different context, you have Emmett Till being killed as a black man for just whistling at a white woman. So in one way, the white female body has to be policed, and in another way, the white female body has to be protected. And so again, you know, as Layla keeps mentioning, it's all these intersections that get embroiled in all of this.
Fascinating stuff. Happy to have you on the program. Emily Stamey, curator of exhibitions at the Wetherspoon Art Museum. Layla Villaverde is a professor in Cultural Foundations of Education at UNCG. Thank you both so much for being on the program. Just ahead, we're going to talk with the only member touring Sacred Steel Band in the state, and we'll get a preview of the Allen Boys right here.